Today I want to move, as I indicated in the arrangement of this series, to a discussion of consideration of what are known as the three vestures, or more properly, the trikaya. Tree is three, and kaya, vesture or robe or garment, however you want to put it. I think one of the interesting passages which occurs in this second fragment on the two paths is in verse 140. I've put on the board only some of the final portion of that verse. Out of the furnace of man's life and its black smoke, winged flames arise, flames purified, that soaring onward, neath the karmic eye, weave in the end the fabric glorified of the three vestures of the path. Marvelous statement. Out of the furnace of man's life and its black smoke, winged flames arise. And it is therefore out of our own experience, out of our pains and anxieties and joys and tribulations and everything else, that come the flames that ultimately are purified, which weave in the end the fabric glorified of the three vestures of the path. And then verse 141, these vestures are the Nirmanakaya, Sambhogyakaya, and Dharmakaya, robe sublime. Now, there are other references to these vestures, but this doctrine, we can call it that, this teaching about the Trikaya, or three vestures, is really peculiar to Mahayana Buddhism, and it constitutes one of the essential differences between the two major schools of Buddhism. According to this, the Buddhist presumes a triple existence for the Tathagata, the Buddha. That is, the Tathagata is conceived as manifesting himself in three different forms of existence. And generally they're called, as I've said, the Dharmakaya, the body of Dharma, which is true being. I will come to that further. The Ginther calls it the presence of Buddhahood as a possibility of actual being, that it's therefore prior to the other vestures and is a process which takes shape in the manifestation of the Buddha. We'll come to that further. The Sambhogyakaya, usually translated the body of bliss, Ginther calls it empathetic Buddhahood. It brings into prominence the factors, he says, of feeling and imagination, the tendencies that are based on the affective appreciation, the aesthetic experience, the empathy as the vitalizing factor. And finally, the Nirmanakaya, which Ginther calls embodied Buddhahood, the concrete actualization, expressing it as speech expresses thought. The individual is both the expression and the expressed. To quote Ginther, who is not always easy, but in his work, Buddhist Philosophy and Theory and Practice, in other words, Buddhahood, absolute in itself, Dharmakaya, manifests, expresses itself in the body proper of an individual, and is manifested by the animatedness of the body proper of an individual, and is manifested or expressed by the animatedness of the body proper. As I told you, he's not easy. So let's try to see what we can discover about this. In order to understand this doctrine of the Trikaya, it may be useful to recognize that a major question that seemed to agitate the minds of the Buddha's disciples concerned his personality. And incidentally, in the what's the fifth volume of the Adyar edition of the Secret Doctrine, or in the Quest edition of the Esoteric Writings of HPB, I'm not sure whether it's volume 12 or 13 in the collected writings, I didn't look it up exactly, HPB has a very interesting essay on the mystery of the Buddha. And indeed there is something of a mystery with regard to the principles that constituted the vehicle. But this was a question that concerned his disciples, the personality. Was he merely a human being like ourselves? And if so, how could he reach the state of perfection? Or was he a divine being? And if so, why did he succumb to the law of birth and death that is the lot of common mortals? In a sense, it's not different from questions that have been asked about Jesus as the Christ and so on. And it was questions such as these that were answered by this doctrine of the Trikaya. In one of the sutras, the Suvarnaprabha Sutra, we read, the Tathagata, when he was yet at the stage of discipline, practiced diverse deeds of morality for the sake of sentient beings. The practice finally attained perfection, reached maturity, and by virtue of its merits, he acquired a wonderful spiritual power. The power enabled him to respond to the thoughts, deeds, and livings of sentient beings, the response that he could give. He thoroughly understood them and never missed the right opportunity to respond to their needs. He revealed himself in the right place and in the right moment. He acted rightly, assuming various bodily forms in response to the needs of mortal souls. These bodily forms are called the Nirmanakaya of the Tathagata. So it's the body of transformation. In one sense, one can say, you see, the Buddha responded to what were the thoughts, the feelings, and the translation here is the livings, the actions, of any being who presented himself. So that he responded in the right way. He thoroughly understood them, never missed the right opportunity to respond to their needs, revealed himself in the right place and in the right moment, acted rightly, assuming, therefore, the form that was needed at the moment. Which is an interesting, we can discuss this a bit later, but these bodily forms are called the Nirmanakaya. But when the Tathagata, in order to make the Bodhisattvas thoroughly conversant with the Dharma, to instruct them in the highest reality, to let them understand that birth and death, or samsara and nirvana, are of one taste, to destroy the thoughts of the ego, individuality, and the fear of transmigration or reincarnation, and to promote happiness, to lay foundation for innumerable Buddha dharmas, to be truly in accord with suchness, or sunyata, the knowledge of sunyata and the spontaneous will, manifest himself to the bodhisattvas in a form which is perfect with the 32 major and 80 minor features of excellence. The Buddhists always have a great long list of what are the features of excellence, you see. 32 major and 80 minor features, and shining with the halo around the head and the back, the Tathagata is said to have assumed the body of bliss, or Sambhogyakaya. So when you see the pictures with the halo and so on, and in which all of the features are those of excellence, and instructing the bodhisattvas. You will see, in fact, at our headquarters, we have a beautiful tanka in the shrine room there, some of you may remember it, that is the Buddha in a variety of positions. You remember it, Mary Jo, in a variety of positions. We were told many years ago by a Buddhist monk coming that those were all of the features of the Sambhogyakaya. And it's a very precious tanka, it's a very beautiful hanging tanka. So in this teaching of the highest reality, to understand that, this is said, samsara and nirvana are of the same taste, of one taste, to destroy the thoughts of I am I, of the egohood, and the fear of reincarnation, to promote happiness, and so on, to all of that, then he has assumed the body of bliss. But then, when all possible obstacles arising from sins, material, intellectual, and emotional, are perfectly removed, and when all possible good dharmas are preserved, there would remain nothing but suchness, nothing but sunyata, and the knowledge of sunyata. This is the Dharmakaya. The first two forms of the Tathagata are provisional and temporal existences, but the last one is a reality wherein the former two find the reason of their existence. Why? Because when deprived of the Dharma of sunyata and of knowledge of non-particularity, no Buddha Dharma can ever exist. Because it is suchness, sunyata, and knowledge of sunyata that absorbs within itself all possible forms of Buddha wisdom and renders possible a complete extinction of all passions and sins arising from particularity. So ultimately, the Dharmakaya, the actual being, that is the actual presence, but manifesting itself in the other two. Suzuki, incidentally, draws a parallel between the triple body of the Tathagata and the Christian Trinity. The body of transformation, corresponding to Christ in the flesh, the body of bliss to Christ in glory, and the Dharmakaya to the Godhead in the statement, I and my Father are one. I think it's an interesting parallel, therefore. Evans Wentz, in his work Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, speaks of the doctrine of the Trikaya as the esoteric trinity of the Northern School, the Mahayana. And he adds, symbolically, the Trikaya constitutes, if one may attempt to describe the indescribable, of course that's what we're always trying to do anyway here, aren't we? Talk about the sacred doctrine or anything else, we're always trying to describe the indescribable. Symbolically, the Trikaya constitutes, if one may attempt to describe the indescribable, the united threefold body of bodhic essence, which sustains all existences and all samsaric things and makes deliverance possible for man. It is synonymous with the thatness of the Vedanta. From the Trikaya there arise and to it return, even as raindrops arise from and return to the sea, all things constituting the universe. Matter in its various aspects as solids, liquids, gases, energies, and the whole of samsaric mind and consciousness. In the Trikaya there exist, in a humanly incomprehensible, impersonalized at-one-ment, all the Buddhas of all the eons. To the world pilgrim on the Mahayanic path of deliverance, the Trikaya is the transcendent refuge and goal. So it's the possibility that is there. And that is what HPB has said in this translation, out of the furnace of our lives, we are weaving this triple vesture. So Evans Wentz puts it, as the first step on this path, the yogin should deeply meditate upon the esoteric significance of the Trikaya, or the three divine bodies through which the Buddha spirit manifests itself and makes Bodhic enlightenment possible for man immersed in the ignorance of samsaric or conditioned existence. The first of these three divine bodies is the Dharmakaya, the divine body of truth. It's hard to translate Dharma, of course, isn't it? But the divine body of truth, the essential formless Bodhi, which symbolizes true spiritual experience devoid of all error. It's perhaps that ultimate spiritual experience in which there is the truthfulness of things, perhaps the genuine mystic experience, the experience of Eckhart and the great mystics. The second, the Sambhogyakaya, symbolizes the reflected divine body of glory, a reflex of the first, in which in an indescribable superhuman state exist the bodhisattvas and buddhas who have postponed their own final entry into nirvana in order to lead unenlightened beings to freedom. The third, the Nirmanakaya, or divine body of incarnation, represents the pure and perfected human form of a Buddha on earth. Thus, the first of the three divine bodies is the essential, the second, the reflected, and the third, the practical aspect, whereby the one wisdom, the one mind, manifests itself. So we have then, in a sense, the essential, the reflected, and then the practical or the manifested aspect of the one wisdom, the one mind. In a Tibetan text, which is often referred to as the Precious Rosary, and translated by Evans Wentz as the supreme path of discipleship, the precepts of the gurus, in his Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrine, it's a work compiled by the successor of Milarepa, known as Gampopa. It's a very beautiful section known as the 10 Great Joyful Realizations. And I like it because, you know, often we speak of this, and HPB does too, as the path of woe. And when we read this out of the furnace of man's life and its black smoke, I left off the black smoke up there on the board. But, you know, we think of our lives as producing perhaps a lot of black smoke at times. The pains and the anxieties and fears and so on. And so HPB often speaks of the path of woe, and I think if one had the kind of incarnation that HPB had, I think one can appreciate why it is that in many ways. And yet, you know, I think it's very hard. I've always thought this, you may not agree, I've always thought it's rather hard to remember pain, but we do remember joy. We do remember happiness. But it is difficult to remember the actual pain. We may remember sorrow, we may remember the suffering, but it's very hard to remember pain. I thought of this the other day when I was in the dentist chair. I think
to allow us to go on, think about women in 26 kids.
Yes, I know it. Yes, I think of this very much, and I'm sure that because, and even writing, I think it was, I can't remember, was it Edna Ferber who said of writing that it's made up of childbirth and a whole batch of other things that are painful, and in a sense it is when you come to do some genuine writing, you know. So I've always liked this 10 Great Joyful Realizations, and the following, I've just chosen a few of them that I think are particularly meaningful in relation to this doctrine of the Trikaya. The fifth of, in fact, I've only chosen 5, 6, and 7, which deal with the triple vestures. The fifth of the joyful realizations, it is great joy to realize that in the Dharmakaya, wherein mind and matter are inseparable, there existeth neither any holder of theories nor any support of theories. And that must indeed be a joyful realization. Wherein mind and matter are inseparable, there exists neither any holder of theories nor any support of theories. Because one has come to beyond theory, beyond opinion, beyond view, to all truthfulness. The footnote to that in Evans Wendt's commentary is, to the truth seeker, whether in the realm of physical or of spiritual science, theories are essential. But once any truth or fact has been ascertained, all theories concerning it are useless. Accordingly, in the Dharmakaya, or state of the fundamental truth, no theory is necessary or conceivable. It is the state of perfect enlightenment of the Buddhas in Nirvana. One can look to that as a joyful realization. And when truth hits us, when it really overwhelms us, as it does at times, doesn't it? It really takes hold of us. Then any theory becomes irrelevant, doesn't it? And the holder of you don't even argue with the holder of a theory. It's just irrelevant, isn't it? So the sixth of the joyful realizations, it is great joy to realize that in the self-emanated, compassionate Sambhogyakaya, there exists no birth, death, transition, or any change. And Evans Wendt comments, the Sambhogyakaya, or divine body of perfect endowment, symbolizes the state of spiritual communion in which all bodhisattvas exist when not incarnate on earth, similar to that implied by the communion of saints. Like the Dharmakaya, of which it is the self-emanated primary reflex, the Sambhogyakaya is a state wherein birth, death, transition, and change are transcended. So there is a joyful realization that there's neither birth nor death nor transition nor any change. Must be marked. Then the seventh of the joyful realizations, it is great joy to realize that in the self-emanated divine Nirmanakaya, there exists no feeling of duality. Yes, it is great joy to realize that in the self-emanated divine Nirmanakaya, there exists no feeling of duality. And Evans Wendt's commentary then is, the Nirmanakaya, or divine body of incarnation, the secondary reflex of the Dharmakaya, is the body or spiritual state in which abide all great teachers or bodhisattvas incarnate on earth. The Dharmakaya, being beyond the realm of samsaric sense perceptions, cannot be sensuously perceived. Hence, the mind of the yogin, when realizing it, ceases to exist as finite mind, as something apart from it. In other words, in the state of transcendental samadhic ecstasy, wherein the Dharmakaya is realized, finite mind attains to at-one-ment with its source, the Dharmakaya. Likewise, in the state of the Nirmanakaya, the divine and the sentient, mind and matter, noumena and phenomena, and all dualities blend in at one-ment. And this the Bodhisattva, when in the fleshly body intuitively feels, he knows that neither he himself nor any sensuous or objective thing has a separate or independent existence apart from the Dharmakaya. So that is a joyful realization. There is no separateness, there's no duality. Anyway, this series of joyful realization concludes with the 10th one. It is great joy to realize that the path to freedom, which all the Buddhas have trodden, is ever-existent, ever-unchanged, and ever-open to those who are ready to enter upon it. So this is what really should fill us, I think, this great joy, this 10th great joy, joyful realization, that the path to freedom which all the Buddhas have trodden is ever-existent, ever-unchanged, and ever-open to those who are ready to enter upon it. I think it's a marvelous. It should make us inwardly joyful no matter what's happening to us outwardly. It should really produce in us that state of an interior ecstasy all the time. I think one of the most lucid explanations of this whole doctrine of the Trikaya is that given by Lama Govinda, Anagarika Govinda, in his work, The Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism, which is a marvelous book, and if you're not familiar with it, it's one that really I highly recommend. I think Lama Govinda was, those of us who knew him, I think he was one of the most beautiful people that ever lived. He visited us at headquarters on several occasions and was a wonderful, wonderful, really truly beautiful person in himself. And I highly recommend this Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. In his chapter, which is in the Part 5, Chapter 1 of Part 5 of the book, The Doctrine of the Three Bodies and Three Planes of Reality. And he points out that every Buddha manifests himself on three planes of reality. Now, in saying that, this is indicating that indeed samsara is one with nirvana. So each is a level of reality, of reality in itself, although from another level may seem to be unreality. That is, it loses its appearance, and only the real remains. The universal, and he speaks of the Dharmakaya, therefore, as the universal, the ideal, and the individual. And we discern these three principles then in the Buddha. As he puts it, these are three bodies or principles. First, that in which all enlightened ones are the same, the experience of completeness, of universality, of the deepest super-individual reality of the Dharma, the primordial law and cause of all things, from which emanates all physical, moral, and metaphysical order. So the Dharmakaya is the thatness, the absolute from which everything then is reflected, the primordial law and cause of all things. Second, that which constitutes the spiritual or ideal character of a Buddha, the creative expression or formulation of this universal principle in the realm of inner vision, the Sambhogyakaya, the body of bliss, rapture, or spiritual enjoyment from which all true inspiration is born. So it's not as distant. It's, you know, those creative moments we have, those inspiring moments, those moments of genuine inspiration, is the reflection in us of the Sambhogyakaya. And third, that in which this inspiration is transformed into visible form and becomes action, the Nirmanakaya, the body of transformation, the human embodiment or individuality of an enlightened one. And of course, HPB, as we know, points out again and again, to don Nirmanakaya's humble robe is to forego eternal bliss for self to help on man's salvation. This is the path, of course, of the Bodhisattva that she is constantly reminding us of. But Lama Govinda makes another significant point that I think is very well worthwhile. He says, seen from the outside, that is from the point of view of conceptual thought, which is really the way we're looking at it at the moment, from the point of view of conceptual thought, the Sambhogyakaya and the Nirmanakaya are manifestations of the Dharmakaya and are contained in the latter, which in this sense presents itself as the higher or more universal principle. Seen from within, that is from the point of view of experience, which is the way we must come at it too, the Sambhogyakaya and the Dharmakaya are contained in the Nirmanakaya. Only in the Nirmanakaya can the other two bodies be experienced and realized. So that if we look at it conceptually, if we think about it, the Dharmakaya seems the highest, and the Sambhogyakaya and Nirmanakaya are, of course, emanations, reflections. But from within, from the point of view of experience, the Nirmanakaya contains the Sambhogyakaya and the Dharmakaya. So that even in manifestation, we begin to express these universal and ideal qualities. And I think Lama Govinda also helps to bring these conditions or states of consciousness a little closer to our own experience. He writes in this chapter, in states of rapture, trance, and highest intuition, as characterized by the stages of deep absorption in meditation, which is dhyana, we experience the Dharmakaya as the luminous forms of purely spiritual perception, as pure, eternal principles of form, freed from all accidentals, or as the exalted visions of a higher reality. In them, in this highest state of meditation, in the highest intuition, where we experience then the truthfulness of all things, the Dharmakaya, the body of truth, the essential Dharma of all things, spiritual perception, in those, the Sambhogyakaya, the body of bliss, is realized. Because then we are one with it. And therefore there is that essential ecstasy or rapture. From it flow all immortal art, all deep wisdom, all profound truths. Its enjoyment is of two kinds, like that of every great work of art, the rapture of the creative act, and the enjoyment of those who contemplate the completed work by retrospectively experiencing and reliving the act of creation. So there is then, as he points out, two kinds of Sambhogyakaya, that which is he calls it the Svasvambhogakaya, the body of pure form, which is perfect, pure, eternal, and universal, which quietly continues and which underlying the entire universe and the entire manifested system is bliss, is ananda, is the experience of in which we can enter into, which is empathy, but underlying that, and that continues, as he said, till the end of time. It will always experience within itself the bliss of the Dharma, the bliss of truth itself. And then the body that causes enjoyment to others, the subtle body with the attribute of purity which all Tathagatas show on account of their knowledge of equality. So there is in this a concept then, this presence, so that one's act in the world, one's feelings and being in the world, in transforming ourselves constantly, so that we are always in this situation of transformation to everyone that is there. That is, we, as I read at the beginning, that characteristic in which we all the time respond to the needs and we're in the right place in the right moment and respond to the needs of others, that all the time there is that establishment in us of truth, of dharma, and of bliss, of the ecstasy of it. Sometimes it's interesting, there's another point that I want to make in this regard, and that is that as Lama Govinda points out, that this whole consciousness of a higher dimension consists in really the coordination, how does he put it, coordinated and simultaneous perception of all of this together. And that therefore, when we use the term body, kaya, which is usually translated as body, robe, or vesture, it calls up, of course, the characteristic that this is only an illusion. And so consequently, the nirmana kaya has sometimes been called an illusory or phantom body. But as Lama Govinda points out, since it is the mind that creates the human body, it follows that the more the mind reflects and is filled with the dharmakaya, the more it will be able to influence and to transform the material body, so that even our outer vehicle becomes transformed by the knowing which is present within. And I think we often feel that. We certainly feel it when we're in the presence of someone who is very calm, very peaceful, very, there's a presence, isn't there? And even the physical body seems to radiate. And we have in the Bhagavad Gita, for example, Krishna whose every pore radiated light, or light was radiated through every pore of his body, taking a form, but seemed translucent, so that light seemed to radiate from it. So one of the fascinating passages in Lama Govinda, which I've always liked, the body of an ordinary human being is maya, that is, it is an appearance, which has been assumed. And also the body of an enlightened one is maya. But that does not mean that the body of an ordinary man can be called a nirmanakaya. The difference is that the body of an enlightened one is his conscious creation, that of an unenlightened one, the creation of his subconscious drives and desires. Both are maya, but the one is conscious and the other unconscious. The one is the master of maya, the other its slave. The difference consists in the knowledge, prajna. So we walk around in bodies that are pretty much the result of karmic circumstances and the result of desires and all the drives, subconscious and otherwise, that have brought about this incarnation. But the body of the nirmanakaya is a conscious creation. Consequently, it's been said, and Lama Govinda points this out, that only in the nirmanakaya, that is, only in the incarnation And this is what HPB is pointing to in The Voice of the Silence. Only in donning Nirmanakaya's humble robe, and only in taking on this form, can we realize the Dharmakaya effectively by converting it into an ever-present conscious force, into an incandescent, all-consuming focus of experience in which all elements of our personality are purified and integrated. I love that statement of Lama Govinda's, that the vehicle itself becomes an incandescent, all-consuming focus of experience, in beautiful terms, in which all the elements of our personality are purified and integrated. And this, of course, is what HPB is. This is what The Voice is saying. Out of the furnace of man's life and its black smoke, winged flames arise, flames purified, that soaring onward neath the karmic eye, weave in the end the fabric glorified of the three vestures of the path. And so, as Lama Govinda points out, this is the transfiguration of body and mind which has been achieved by the greatest saints. The Nirmanakaya, therefore, is the highest form of realization, the only one, in fact, that can open the eyes even of the spiritually blind worldling. It is the highest fruit of perfection, for the sakes of which the Buddhas have exerted themselves in innumerable previous existences over vast periods of time. So this teaching of the Trikaya is, I think, one of the sublimest in the entire range of occultism. And it's presented to us here in The Voice of the Silence. It's in order to bring forth into self-conscious functioning this living, threefold Buddhic essence in the constitution of every individual that the masters of wisdom and compassion, when themselves on the threshold of nirvana, renounce that lofty state and return to guide and teach humanity. This is the ideal that is set before us, that even here in physical incarnation, we come to embody Dharma and bliss, that truthfulness, that essential truthfulness, and the bliss that derives from it, because that is so. Out of the path of woe comes the what Evans Wentz has translated as the 10 great joyful realizations, wonderfully joyful realizations. And I think that the final one, I'll just read it again before we adjourn, because this is indeed the ultimate joyful realization. To realize, it is great joy to realize that the path to freedom which all the Buddhas have trodden is ever existent, ever unchanged, and ever open to those who are ready to enter upon it. And I think part of our responsibility then is helping those who are ready to see that there is a way. I mean, after all, that's why the Theosophical Society exists, to show that there is a way, there is a path, and it leads, therefore, to that truthfulness which underlies all existence. Well, much more could be said, of course, about the Trikaya. I certainly recommend that if you're interested in pursuing this, that Lama Govinda's explanation and his chapter on the Nirmanakaya as the highest form of realization, and the Dharmakaya and the mystery of the body, all of this section really is extremely valuable, because it's really the communication, as he points out, the communication simply by one's being, or as he says, it is not the audible word through which people are converted and transformed in their innermost being, but through that which goes beyond words and flows directly from the presence of the saint, the inaudible mantric sound that emanates from his heart. This constant What are we emanating? What is the body saying? All right, well, let's pause, and then we have much to consider. Around then, about the Trikaya, and the fact that we are all the time weaving these vestures for ourselves, if we can determine to do so consciously. There's one other passage that I wanted to read from Lama Govinda before we enter into the discussion. In his chapter on the Dharmakaya and the mystery of the body, he points out that, of course, the Dharmakaya is not only an abstract principle, but a living reality which manifests itself. And so it's the word body or kaya is used really in a metaphorical sense, as he says, namely, in that of a realm of conscious reality and spiritual activity, forming an organic whole comparable to the physical body. And so he points out that the while the personality of the ordinary individual, what we can call the spiritually undeveloped human being, the individual who's not even aware that there is another dimension to life than eating, drinking, and making money, and going to bed, having sex, and so on, all of that, that personality is confined to its material form of appearance, its physical body. Whereas the personality, as he says, of a spiritually advanced man comprises not only the material part of his form of appearance, but also his mental, psychic, and spiritual functions, his consciousness body, which reaches far beyond the limits. And I think we sense that often in individuals, don't we? Whether the individual is just so focused in the physical body that that's really all there seems to be to the individual. There's been no thought of anything beyond. There's been no feeling beyond his own sensations and his own gratification. And I think we sense that, whereas I think there is that feeling when you meet different individuals that there is something beyond the physical, and perhaps often we want to know, you know, well, what is it that makes you tick? What is it that makes you different, and so on? And so, as he also points out, in a man who lives in his ideals or in his thoughts, which go beyond the realm of individual interests and experiences, then this kind of consciousness body, this sense of a structure of consciousness, extends into the realm of universally valid truths, into the realm of the beautiful, of creative power, of aesthetic enjoyment and intuitive insight. And then he says, to the enlightened man, however, whose consciousness embraces the universe, to him the universe becomes his body. And we often feel this in the presence of really great people. While his physical body becomes a manifestation of the universal mind, his inner vision an expression of the highest reality, and his speech an expression of eternal truth and mantric power. I must admit, I often think of our late president, Sri Ram, whom many of us knew and admired so much. And I always felt that Sri Ram's speech, when he gave a talk, there was a kind of mantric power that was conveyed. And he chose his words so very carefully. I think he had the most beautiful vocabulary in English of anyone I've ever known. He really seemed to always say exactly the right word at the right time and in the right place, and it was beautifully chosen. So as Govinda says, here the mystery of body, speech, and mind finds its ultimate consummation and reveals itself in its true nature as the three planes of action on which all spiritual events take place. So that it's a unification. And I think his use of the terms, the mystery of body, speech, and mind. So that the beautiful mind reflects itself in beautiful speech, but beautiful speech is the evidence of the truthfulness of the consciousness. So, well, as I say, there are many passages, as you probably know, in the Voice of the Silence, referring to these vestures. But by quoting this first one that I've come to in verse 140, I hope I've indicated that these are not something far away and beyond us. They are something we're weaving all the time in the furnace of our lives. So I thought I'd put it as a question that we consider: how can we transform our pains into bliss? Which is that out of this black smoke, painfulness, is there a way or a mode, a manner, by which we can not so much, and I'm thinking not just of, you know, pains of being in the kind of physical pain of being in the dentist chair or arthritic pain or neuralgic pain or when we fall down and the physical pain, but I'm thinking of pains in the deeper sense. Is there a way that we can begin to transform those so that we're beginning to weave this vesture of true bliss?
In the Voice of the Silence, as the one with the puzzle with the need to bless.
Yes, that this does, of course, the path of woe becomes the path of bliss. You see. So how can we even now begin to transform what we think of as painful experiences, our pains, our anxieties, if you like? I've tried to include everything under pains, but into genuine bliss.
Would it be on the one word, forgiveness? In other words, we forgive ourselves, we forgive others too?
I think there's a very good point in that, Stanley, yes, that there is forgiveness, and we forgive ourselves and we forgive others.
I was wondering if it's possible when we're suffering to let ourselves feel the very depths of the suffering and to milk, you might say, milk the essence of it out into our deepest self until there is no more suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You suppose
I like that, Bob. I personally respond to that, that you really go into the very depths of it, and I like that analogy. You really milk it of its very being, and how do the others of you respond to that?
The people who work with terminally ill and elderly patients,
mm-hmm.
Stephen Levine, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, people like that, write books, give talks about that very thing. Even have guided meditations that help people to open up to, accept, kind of become friends with, absorb whatever it is, their pain, their suffering, their sorrow, the thought of dying or the actual physical pain, and make friends with that. And it's kind of that nothingness or that negative experience turns into kind of a friend after a while, and they get deepened by it, they get more whole by it, they're not afraid of it, the fear melts off, the whole experience turns into almost a joy when they accept it and they begin to work with it and get in touch with it. There's a lot of work being done.
Yes, uh-huh. a very good...
Krishnamurti went into that too, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Krishnaji very often spoke of this, and really go into your suffering, go into what is your pain, experience it to the fullest. Yes, yes, very... Yes.
I think another step between those two opposite poles is that of compassion, which arises from having experienced pain yourself, you then, I think, can respond to it with all others.
Mm-hmm.
And then the joy of being able to share and thereby lighten their loads, I think, mm-hmm. can be on the way to this.
Yes, that's true, yes, right. Mm-hmm. Jocelyn?
I think the physical model that was very beautifully explained on Saturday by the gentleman, the Vietnamese gentleman, just bought a smoke. Mm-hmm. He's currently managed to walk in meditation with the Yogi, he used the analogy of the composting. He started off with a beautiful flower arrangement. And he said, you know, in 7 days, this will be ready for the rubbish tin. But it's just as precious because this is our compost from which life grows. And what we have to do is nurture it so that it can be here. So we have cycles in nature which go from death to birth, to death to birth. You talked about the rain.
Yes. It's all cycles,
and
yes.
And so therefore it must be in ourselves too,
that our, what we think of as negative and horrific experiences are actually great blessings, because they enable us to complete this
new
life.
Otherwise we'd be
very
stuck.
Mm-hmm.
That would be
the
deal.
Yes.
Ever moving, mm-hmm. and we are part of it, and so whatever, whenever we reach those depths,
mm-hmm.
we're going to come up and go through the highs as well.
Mm-hmm.
Could you rewrite the question and say, how can we ensure that we remain on the wheel of birth and death, or how can we ensure that we're remaining samsara by trying to transform pain into bliss, and if you find that you're in bliss, then you're constantly worried, how am I going to maintain the bliss?
Yes.
Don't want to sink back into pain, and it becomes the vicious circle, the wheel of life again.
Yes.
So, I think what you have to do is say, where do you go when you get the bliss? I mean, I think it's advised in some of the books I've read that you, particularly in the Vajrayana thing where they do deity yoga, that one accepts the bliss, but you also meditate on the emptiness and the bliss too.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find the emptiness and the bliss and the emptiness and the pain, then you what you're really doing then is converting it into Dharmakaya.
Mm-hmm.
And to take it a little step further, not further than Dharmakaya, but as far as some of these transformations, when a bodhisattva, an enlightened bodhisattva dies, what he does is manifest through his merit and his wisdom. The Sambhogakaya, then finding the emptiness in that, converts, goes into the Dharmakaya, into the body of truth,
mm-hmm.
and becomes a full Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you're right. I think that there is a logical next step. What do we do with the bliss, so to speak? Do we stay there, or how do we approach the world of samsara, maintaining this?
Stuck in something, not able to move forward.
That's right.
If you're stuck in this, not able to same way.
Yes, we can get stuck in either one, and I think that's what Lowell was saying, that you...
Well, that's the middle path.
That's the middle path again.
Is to hold the bliss of the pain in one hand and integrate it with the reality, the ultimate reality of the emptiness of both.
Yes, of both, yes. So that, but, you know, I think discovering techniques for how we do this, for example, going deeply into it, really, really letting it be, acceptance of the pain and acceptance of the bliss, and so that one sees this as a cycle always, and going on into, as you say, into the truthfulness, which is the suchness, the
The bliss and the pain as in their compound aggregation of the reality. That the bliss came from certain actions, certain needs being met, certain other biological functions happening because of it, and on and on. And then the same thing with the pain, whether the reality of age and deterioration, of bad alignment in social things, the family, or with a job, or whatever it is, and take it apart unit by unit and see the reality of the pain and see the reality of bliss, and to see that they are composed of an aggregate of situations, either one, any one of them.
Yes.
And that's the emptiness and ending.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I keep going back to what Bob said. I was I really identified with what he was saying, and what struck me while he was talking was not necessarily turning your wheels and trying to understand, but to acknowledge what it is that happens to you, be it on either end of the scale. I think if you try to understand it, you get wrapped up in a lot of mind games of leading over, but if you simply acknowledge it, experiences that you have.
Is a good word too for what you were saying, Bob, to acknowledge it, to really acknowledge it, and therefore derive from it, to milk it. But I like that word, to acknowledge it, to acknowledge the situation.
Would that be the same as surrender?
No.
I don't think so, Anita. I don't think it's exactly the same as surrender.
But it's close.
But it's close.
The feelings that surrender, that word gives you, the connotation of it is...
letting go, or...
It may be a letting go, yes.
It's all right. It's okay.
It's all right. It's all right.
It's okay. This is what's happening.
Don't fight it.
In other
words.
Well,
I think this is what Roger was saying, too, in many of these therapies now, for example, dealing with the death and dying, for example, that and there are now a friend Virginia Hansen, whose son died last year, and her daughter-in-law has been going to some group of, what are they calling, you know, where they help the people that are grieving. And one of the points is, evidently, that it's all right to cry. It's all right to experience the grief, to go through the grief, and to experience it, and that it's perfectly legitimate to cry. They're support groups. And I think that is an acknowledgement that it's perfectly all right to experience these. So it's not just surrender, but yet there is surrender in it, you're right. But it's an acknowledgement of the situation.
Surrender has a negative.
I think maybe that's the thing, yes. Nancy?
I think part of that then is the eventual integration.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really integrate until you're experience it. Mm-hmm. So, the support group, as long as it's trapped inside and it isn't expressed, mm-hmm. then there's no way of bringing that back in and putting it into another form. Mm-hmm.
I do think what Murray has said too, this matter of compassion. You remember in the life of the Buddha, as told by Sir Edwin Arnold, for example, and is that beautiful story of the mustard seed, of the young woman who came to the Buddha with a child who was ill, and he, of course, recognizing that the child had really already died, the Buddha told her to go to get a mustard seed, but it must come from a house in which no death had occurred. Well, of course, there wasn't any such house in the village, and obviously in India would never be such a house in a village in which some death had not occurred, a servant, a husband, a wife, a child, a grandparent, some death had occurred. And so she returned that everyone was willing to give the mustard seed, but there was no house in which death had not occurred. And the Buddha, of course, counseled her then. This is the condition. This is the human condition. Go thou and bury thy child. And that there is that universality. And this is part of the integration, isn't it? Is the recognition which brings compassion, because then one knows that while in one sense one has suffered alone, one never does suffer alone, because all sufferings are common to the human condition, which is dukkha, of course. It is. But then, what do we, is the bliss then a transitory bliss, or is it an underlying realization? Maybe bliss is the wrong word then. Is it an underlying realization which comes to the Dharma, the Dharma nature, which is present in all things, the truthfulness which is present, that underlying that is this kind of serenity. I like the word serenity myself, that there is a deep underlying serenity that one can participate in out of all of that. Well, the other question I asked, because I think this is, when we're talking about experience, you see, out of the furnace of man's life, verse 114, which also is in this second, fragment on the two paths, the entire verse, or the first part of it, which I didn't quote here, the seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. Now, it's certainly true that we do not grow wise in a vacuum. And I think that's a marvelous phrase. The seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. To live and reap experience, the mind needs breadth and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. What do you think is the meaning of that?
First of all, I'm not clear what the word points means in this context.
Neither am I. You see, that's why I think it's very interesting. The mind needs breadth and depth and points. So one has to use one's intuition as to what is meant by the points.
Do you think that there are literal spots of experience when we break and dip, but we also, they're sort of ephemeral in terms of experience. I mean, mm-hmm. there are different points for the actualities of various
I think that might well be one way to read. You see, HPB doesn't explain that. It's not in any of the notes. So we don't know what she translated, but that's the way she has it.
Like points on graph, if you're graphing something,
yes.
You've got width
mm-hmm.
there.
And depth.
dip there and then look at the top, which all depends on the mind.
Well, the way that I understand it from my experience is that the mind will be in space, quiet space, in order to come in contact with the essential nuances of the experience, emotion, the subconscious, integrate them together. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, one has to quiet down, come in contact with the body, and those things which are giving you thoughts, dealing with the experiences,
You see, it's to live and reap experiences, not just to experience, but to live and reap experience, which is, I take reap experience to mean to reap from the events, to harvest this in one's life.
Could you say digest it?
To digest it, perhaps, yes, that would be another way to say
it. Bringing some form of art as a result of this experience, the evidence of this thing we're talking about?
Oh, I think very much so, yeah. Marjorie, I think so. Certainly there are many therapies that use art, and I think, you know, I've often felt that for myself, out of some deep experience, to write a poem, to write something. Usually, I don't know whether it can be called poetry. You know, I would hesitate to call it that, but I always think of what Monk Gibbon said, that just as even the worst smelly cheese is still cheese, so that so the worst poems may still be called poetry. But anyway, to write something in a poetic vein, I have found, which is true, and I suppose others would go to the piano or to the violin or the viola or to paint, to express in some way, and that may be another interpretation of points. You know that there are these points through which the creative finds its expression, as well as the points that focus our attention. So there may be different interpretations. I think we have to sort of meditate on what that means ourselves. John?
I can't get that point of pain toothache out of my head, but maybe if you can make the point a pinch. Like, I remember I once was having my teeth cleaned, and the dentist was already stuck that big needle up in the hearing of Devin, and he said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "It's only a pinch." So I thought of a pinch, and he was through with it. So if you make the point a pinch, then you give us the breadth and depth to the mind. And you're exploring toward the soul. That's the much they can say.
Well, that's way. I mean, sometimes karma pinches us in strange places. It's true. Mary Jo?
Yeah, that diamond soul. You think of a many, many facets of diamond radiating light and beauty.
Yes.
And perhaps the mind has to create a sort of diamond body, a multifaceted body of experiences and awareness that ultimately, I don't know, reflects the beauty of the diamond soul, or mirrors it in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that phrase, the diamond soul, is a beautiful, and we see the facets then, and each one needing to be polished. And the polishing is probably like a cleaning of teeth, is not always a pleasant experience. Yes, Mary.
To me, it seems like a triangle. It's a triangle. And you need the breath to extend your horizons beyond the conditioning circumstances of situations, and the depth to penetrate through the illusion.
and that point of attainment, which you're trying to draw yourself to.
That's a nice one,
creates a triangle.
It creates a triangle.
There's a point of attainment out there, which you're striving towards, as you're drawn towards that diamond soul.
Yes, that's a beautiful image. That's a beautiful image, and the point is the point of attainment.
That you need that breath of perception, that the barriers of conditioning and circumstance and depth to see what lies beyond. You know, that point of attainment that's not there.
So I think that's a beautiful image. I like that image very much. Yes. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Well, we exhausted that? Yes, Jocelyn.
Comment on the diamond soul that Mary Jo was talking about. as she was speaking, it just occurred to me, I know nothing about the making of stones, but I have heard that to make a facet in a diamond requires an awful lot of work, a lot of grinding away.
It certainly does.
And that must be surely symbolical for us in the grinding away of all the flocks and jets and putting people on the surfaces of our lives. That's got to be ground down by the pain and difficult experiences.
And in a sense, you see, there's putting it in the furnace of our life, isn't it? You know, where the heat is really raised to an extreme degree at times.
But even this is just a surface thing. It's still a bit of irritation. You think, okay, I've been through the furnace. Oh boy, give me a break. You know, you still want to have the sandpaper on
the sandpaper on the skin. Yes, that's right.
A diamond is a seal of love, actually, on the, you know, on the ring. So, it's that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, it's a symbol of many things, isn't it? Yes. Very true. Roger?
A symbol that has meant a great deal to me in relationship to the pain being turned into joy is the image of birthing. A mother giving birth that fights the process and does not cooperate and just tries to tense up and to not experience the pain and not go with the whole flow of the process will come away with just the experience of the pain for the most part and slow it up and kind of complicate the whole process. Whereas if they're in touch with it, almost kind of a spirit of cooperating with the child, like there's two, it's almost a team effort, that it can be a whole different experience in turning pain into something that then becomes joy. It's more of a flowing sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think undoubtedly birthing is perhaps one of the best examples.
Because a woman can kind of sort of give up, which looks like kind of a surrender, and just kind of cop out of the situation and let painkillers and just physiological automatic responses kind of take over, or they can stay in there consciously and try to, you know, be part of what's happening, and it's a whole different experience for them.
Perhaps this is related to seeing everything as mother, that everything then does give birth and nurtures.
Now, if you go back to the first chapter in the Judeo-Christian scriptures, that God created man in his image, which means the creator made little creators. Mm-hmm. We're all mothers.
We're all mothers.
We're all giving birth to something constantly.
Right. Yes.
And that's the real meaning of what being on planet Earth is all about, is to be a creator.
It is. It certainly is. And that's why to look at everything and everyone, all sentient beings are mothers. And so all give birth, and so there is this, and we too are mothers in that sense. We're all mothers.
That certainly has brought out India quite a bit.
Yes, it is, very much so. Definitely. Well, I hope this has been practical, even though we're talking about the condition, ultimate condition of Buddhahood, as it were. it certainly, I think, relates right here and now to the fact that we're weaving this fabric of the fabric glorified. We're weaving it at every moment, and we're bringing these expressions about. We can do it consciously, or we can do it unconsciously. And the whole point, of course, is that we are to be conscious of what we're doing, and conscious of experience, conscious of how it is affecting us, conscious of how we handle it, our attitude. Come back to the fact that basic, then, to the whole Buddhist philosophy is the attitude, isn't it? The path of seeing, which is right views, which is the very first of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a right seeing, a right viewing, a right attitude, and then practicing that which one has seen.
I'm just cogitating on the word, breath and depth. Mm-hmm. How does one go about creating both of them? I mean, mm-hmm. it's like, shall I specialize, or do I want to be a generalist in life, how do you decide if you want to do both, but you don't do either very well, possibly? How does one regulate one's life profitably in the direction?
It's a question, and I think, you see, these raise questions for us. As Nairi said, the breadth perhaps is the wider and wider perception. At the same time that one also has to go deeper and really come to the very depths of experience.
Coordinated up with the idea of the black smoke.
Of the black smoke.
Black smoke, and smoke, of course, is incomplete combustion. Mm-hmm. So there is a certain quality, I guess it's inherent in this problem we have, is that we're going to do things incompletely. And we're going to be somewhat haphazard. But as I heard one Buddhist say, we don't have to perfect our everything we've ever done, because we're not going to remain there. But to keep going on and open up those channels, open up those perceptions, even though you don't bring them to high perfection. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying, what if by nature you're narrow-minded, you might say, oversimplify the breadth and depth, what if you do not have the means, and by inclination you might be a narrow, how do you widen that?
There again, I would say it's probably a matter of integration, a compromise. I mean, we can specialize in our work, we can very become very specialized in what we do, say, in work, but yet we have to grow in the area of social, in family, in other responsibilities, altruistic aspirations. Or we can be very general in our work, and we can be just most fantastic parents, and really handle things really great in that way, and see how that projects that into our work. We can say we come and do art for a living, and then suddenly see how art pervades all of our experience in other fields. That may be a way of doing it too. I don't know, but I mean, I'm just playing with an idea that you brought up.
There may be a variety of ways.
The point is not to be narrow, but in sharpening your perceptions and your focusing in on whatever you do, there is a possible flowering proliferation, that if you have the desire and the eye to see it, you can see the narrowness proliferate into generalization.
Into general,
there's a saying that the essence of knowledge is generalization.
Mm-hmm. Yes. May, you were...
Well, going back to the first question there, I get the idea for myself that we just kind of surrender. Mm-hmm. And coming into the second question there, if everything is sort of general, we really don't know where we're growing in debt, mm-hmm. what we're growing in debt. Where these points are coming up, we really don't know. We're experiencing, we're going through them, so we don't have any control necessarily of what we are experiencing, how our depth is growing and expanding, and so forth. I don't think that we have a part, really, in the experiences that we're going through. We may try to control them, but as we grow, there are too many other things, too many other factors that are happening to us that we have absolutely no control over.
Could I make a suggestion that perhaps we need to understand, to look at what is an experience? I have at least it has helped me, a little way of looking at it, which would say that we do have control, and I think ultimately we must have control. That experience is not when an event happens to us, but when we happen to an event. There are events there. You happen to the event. That is, you bring yourself to it. That turns the event into an experience. Now, I can control, I really hope I can, I mean, I hope I can learn to control my reaction to that event, which is therefore controlling my experience of the event. Because this, it comes back to attitude in the path of seeing, and I can determine, and I think this is the whole process that the voice of the silence points to, that the spiritual path points to, is that we must take charge of our responses. And it's those responses that constitute experience and what I derive, therefore, from the event. The event is simply there. You see?
I would go along with that. But what I was just saying is, mm-hmm. I don't know how I'm experiencing.
Well, it may not, yes. It may not be in some outer measurable way. But I think often we do have a kind of interior measurement that perhaps one has one's own scale, so to speak, but that am I now able to respond with compassion to all people, whereas 50 years ago I wasn't able to respond with compassion. How quickly do I lose my temper today compared to the way in which I lost it as a child or something like that? I think we have our own internal kind of, perhaps not measurement, but a kind of internal understanding.
I think the awareness and the evaluation of the awareness mm-hmm. is what makes the growth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But also, I can relate to exactly what May said. And there are stages of your life when you, like in perhaps the earlier stages before we attain whatever we are now, you might really realize, you don't really realize that what you're going through is a growth process mm-hmm. until you look back on it.
Yes.
But then at our sort of stage of learning, mm-hmm. we may not know what growth is, but we think, like, just we roll.
It's part of our growth, yes.
Still not completely aware until perhaps after some long time. Yes, that's what it was about. Mm-hmm. Yes. But it sort of seems to be a blend of the two.
I think there is a blend.
There is a sort of unconscious growth pattern going on, which is not completely conscious at the time.
But later we can learn, yes, we can look back.
Or we can be aware, yes, I know it's not.
Again, I say that my experience of going going on, the events and experiences, and be able to get an understanding from a different level, mm-hmm. see what's, how it's affecting, what these experiences are going to affect, what our desires are around the experience, mm-hmm. and how those patterns are repeated. Mm-hmm. We're able to see those patterns by quieting down regularly and different to look at one's life and experience and how those things come up. Familiar feelings around the experience, it has to do with past experience, and able to see the pattern and then just at that point of seeing something changes
mm-hmm.
too.
Yes.
And one doesn't say it's an awareness.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is a matter of awareness, and it is true. Often we can look back and we see, well, yes, I did learn something out of that. There was a growth in a sense of the process.
Well, I think we learn to evaluate our choices.
Mm-hmm.